everybody. Welcome to a special episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm Jace. In this episode, I'm going to be playing you my interview with Charles Soule, the comic writer of Daredevil. He also writes his creator-owned property, Letter 44, Uncanny Inhumans with James Asmus over at Marvel, and of course a couple Star Wars titles, the recently announced Poe Dameron series, and he's currently working on the Obi-Wan Anakin Skywalker limited series. So Charles is always really fun to talk to. He's one of my favorite comic writers, very talented. So I'm going to go ahead and play that for you now. In the interest of full disclosure, just realize that this interview took place on the floor of the comic convention. So I have tried to edit out when people came up to his table during our interview. And also, there were announcements over the loudspeaker overhead. So if it seems a little choppy, that's the reason. And you're going to get some more background noise than normally you hear on the podcast just because of the noise of the convention around us. So I apologize for that. I hope you enjoy the interview. And if you're not reading Letter 44 or his recently launched Daredevil title from Marvel, I recommend both those titles, especially Letter 44. So hope you enjoy the interview, and we'll talk to you next time. All right, this is Jace from the Comic Source. I'm here with one of my favorite comic creators, Charles Soule, at the Amazing Arizona Comic Con. How are you doing today, Charles?
I'm doing well. Thanks very much for talking to me. It's always nice to chat.
Yeah, and you write 1,000 books, it seems like. Keep yourself busy, so we're going to touch on a few of them today.
Sounds good.
So let's talk about Daredevil first.
Sure.
I don't know if it's your most high-profile project, maybe other than Poe. There's a lot of talk about it, a lot of expectation, especially following Mark Waid and Chris Samnee's award-winning run.
Yes.
How has the reception on the book been so far from what you've heard from fans?
Honestly, it's been fantastic. I've been very gratified because it seems to be working for both new fans and old fans of Daredevil. So people who have been reading Daredevil since, you know, the Stan Lee days all the way through the Mark Waid run that just ended, as well as people who primarily know Daredevil from the TV show on Netflix. So, I mean, I mostly wanted to write something that felt new and fresh after Mark's run, which was a real challenge because it was a brilliant, brilliant story that I loved immensely. I think what Mark and Chris and Paulo Rivera earlier did on that was just some of the best superhero storytelling I've ever seen. I look at his original number one as one of the best introductions to a series character that, like, I've ever read. Mark Waid is a brilliant, brilliant writer. So, very intimidating. Fortunately, I have Ron Garney on board doing the art, and I think it's some of the best he's done. He's really giving it a very unique tone, so it feels dark and special and, like, prominent in a way. Like, you're reading something that matters. It's not just the same thing. And then I'm just trying to struggle along and write some good stories at the same time. So I've been, again, very, very gratified by the response. I have a long-term plan for the Daredevil run, and if things continue to go well, I'll get to do it all.
I love that you use that word prominent to describe his art. I hadn't thought about it, and in fact, when I was coming up with questions, what I wanted to talk to you about, the art was something I wanted to touch on, and I kind of struggled myself to find a good way to put it, but there's a prominence to the art that does make it feel visceral and real, and like the stories matter. One thing I did notice, and admittedly I've never been the hugest Daredevil fan. I've read a lot of the iconic stories, Born Again and such, but just being a comic fan for so long, and Daredevil being a classic character, he's been around a long time, so I've come back into touch with the character from time to time. He's always felt like a very solitary character to me.
Yep.
And what you're doing with him kind of mentoring this new hero, Blindspot, it's kind of going away from that. It has sort of like a legacy, like a mentor feel.
Yep.
Where it's not so much one man against the world.
Yes. And I think a lot of that is rooted in the fact that when we pick up the Daredevil story in Daredevil number one, there's been a lot of changes in Matt's life. He has a secret identity back. He is now working as a prosecutor as opposed to a defense attorney. And he has this apprentice character. And it's all, again, part of a much larger plan, but the idea was that he has very consciously decided to give himself a fresh start, to try things that he has not tried before, and the effort to maybe change the path. Because, you know, as we've seen with Daredevil, things have been very tragic for him for a very long time, and this is an attempt to try and get around that if he can.
But tragic's definitely a word that's used to describe Matt Murdock's path through life. And so what you're saying makes a lot of sense, that maybe it's time for him to try something different, so the people in his life and he himself don't have to go through these so much of this
trauma and these events that it ends up being that he just, it, him against the world.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like Daredevil is a character that has been able to really realistically examine what it would be like if a person were to put on a costume and start beating up criminals. And you know, almost every really solid iteration of Daredevil has really looked at that thoroughly. Even the TV show version, and even, you know, the Ben Affleck movie. Like, it's always been a big part of his makeup, is the cost of what he does. And ultimately, it's absolutely ridiculous. He's a blind man. Yes, he has the super senses, but he is a blind man. And it's just crazy to me that he would do this, especially, like, as I'm an attorney myself. And so the idea that a licensed attorney who has a raft of ethical obligations would choose to do this, it's ludicrous. And so finding a way to make it make sense to him, which I think is a lot of what he does all the time, is tries to make his life make sense to him, is at the heart of these changes that we see in the beginning of the run with Ron, the new run that I've been doing. So we'll see how they play out. You know, Daredevil's life tends to get very complicated very quickly, and that's going to be absolutely the case with my story. There's a lot of good stuff coming up. I hope people will enjoy it.
I find it interesting that you came up with this, I don't want to call him a sidekick, he's not a sidekick, but this. So you came up with this character that he's mentoring, call him Blind Spot, the parallels between Matt Murdock being blind but still being able to see, and then Blind Spot, who has these powers to be invisible.
Yep.
Was that conscious on your part?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it fits pretty well if it wasn't conscious. Yes, it was all conscious. And the other aspect of Blind Spot that fits into his power set and the name he chose for himself is that he's what's called an undocumented immigrant. So he is essentially, you know, like an illegal alien in common parlance. And so he's a young man, he's like 19, who was brought to America by his mom when he was very young. So he doesn't have citizenship and he can't get it because he's illegal, but he's still here and he's still part of America. He was raised as an American, basically. So it's very frustrating and challenging because he can't really access American society in a full-fledged way, but yet he doesn't know anything else. And it's, I think, and he's part of a community of a bunch of other people who are in that same situation, people his age, older, younger. And so to have a hero from that background decide that he's going to start trying to help in a very sort of hands-on way by putting on a costume and so on and all that, I think there's a lot of resonance to it. I think there's a lot of parts of his story that are going to be hopefully certainly interesting to me, hopefully interesting to readers.
He's a part of the society. He exists. He's a person. And yet, from a certain standpoint of the American system,
He's invisible. Hey. Yep.
I'm very interested to learn more about him. He's one of the most intriguing things about the story. There's a reference to batteries early on. He needs batteries. Like, how exactly his powers work. I can't wait to see you explore that more. And then there were a couple of moments in the first three issues that I wanted to ask you about. The first would be in the first issue when Daredevil dives into the river using kind of almost a sonar, in our sense.
Yep.
That felt like a very classic Daredevil moment to me.
Sure, that was the hope.
How much did you collaborate with Ron when you came up with that idea?
Quite a bit. I mean, the scripts are designed to give him a lot of room to move, but I also explain, for that beat, I said, I want Radar Sense to look and feel different than it did in the last run, because again, a lot of it was reinventing, trying to find ways to approach the same concepts in a way that would feel fresh. So it was like, all right, this is our first big use of Radar Sense, let's figure out a way to do it that feels different. Second, this is the type of beat we're going for. This is the way I think it could work. If you have a better visual sense of it, please go for it. And then he delivered that, which I thought, like, when I first started seeing the heavy blacks and, like, you know, the darkness of the river under the water at night, it was amazing. And then Matt Miller, who's the colorist on the series, delivered some really, really cool ideas about how to represent Radar Sense visually. With it, it almost looks like a film negative, like the color scheme is flipped, which is very cool, and you get it right away. And, you know, when you work with these artists and technicians of this caliber, you can really say, this is what we're going for, but you don't have to hold their hand in every last detail. You can just kind of say, this is what we want, and then see what they do. And it's amazing.
Yeah, it worked beautifully. And the last thing about Daredevil, I have to ask you about Elevator Shaft for Matt's office.
Where that's I didn't make that up. As part of my research for it. So I'm an attorney, but I'm not a litigator, and I've never been a DA. So I met with some DA contacts and interviewed them and talked to them about what the Manhattan DA's office is like, and one of them was in that office. So the Elevator Shaft office is real. They ran out of space, so they had a decommissioned elevator shaft, and they put him in the bottom of it. So, you know, that's where his desk was. So it's one of those things that just feels like I couldn't not use it. That was too perfect. So.
Right. Yeah, it gives it a little sense of realism, and yeah, I had a feeling like maybe you'd heard a story or had met someone. Yeah, I just thought that was such a great touch. Adds, you know, realism.
Yeah.
In a way you wouldn't necessarily think. Let's touch on Inhumans.
Sure.
All Inhumans you're writing with Marvel. I feel like there are certain themes that you're getting to explore in Inhumans that are very different from what you're doing in Daredevil. Relationship, family.
Yep.
Are those some of the things that you're focused on with Inhumans?
Absolutely. You look at the story that I tell in, you know, even starting with the Inhuman series, running through Uncanny Inhumans, which is the book I'm doing now, and then the All New Inhumans book, which is you know, I'm sort of co-writing it with James Asmus, and the fact that the Inhumans are a family, they're a royal family, no less. There's a bloodline there, and they relate to each other both as members of that bloodline, but also the way that you would relate to a sibling or a parent or a child. Makes them feel very fresh and different, I think, anyway. And it's not something that you necessarily see the same way in the X-Men or, you know, Fantastic Four. Even, like, it all feels, you got to find your way in that doesn't feel like everything else. And I think that those aspects, the royalty, the family side of things, and then the fact that there's a whole bunch of these new humans who have popped up who are not part of that lineage, it's all makes a very complex, interesting dynamic that I can play with a lot.
I always feel like one of the strengths of your writing is the characterization. How much have you pulled from your own experiences growing up to, you know, as far as family dynamic and things like that? Is that something you
do? I mean, I think we all do. You know, when I'm writing you know, husband-wife relationship with, like, Medusa and Black Bolt, you know, you look at couples you've known and things that might have happened to them and conflict in their lives. I have siblings, you know, you look at the relationships you have and you draw on them. And but also, you know, I've been exposed to many, many different types of family relationships and reading and pop culture consumption. And so you kind of get a sense of how families work. But, you know, the more you can write what you know, the better.
Do you feel like, I mean, the Inhumans have been around for a long time.
Yep.
But 60s. I wouldn't say that they necessarily have been at the forefront of a lot of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, very, very few.
So do you feel like that you're in a unique position to kind of settle their place in the Marvel Universe?
Or that's, kind of that establish? Is literally the job. I mean, when I was hired to start writing Inhuman a couple years ago, that was the gig, was to figure out a way to make them prominent and to make them fixtures in the Marvel Universe that felt, you know, if I've been doing my job right, they will feel like they've been there all along to a certain extent. They will feel like they are, you know, especially with the news stories, they'll feel just like, you know, they always should have been there. So it's been really fun. I've gotten to work with some amazing artists, Steven Niven, obviously, and Ryan Stegman and Joe Madureira and all these other great guys. And, you know, it's part of a big concerted effort to show people how cool these characters are.
Yeah, that is a challenge, though, right? I mean, people come up, they know Spider-Man. They know, you know, you wrote Death of Wolverine. They know Wolverine.
Yep.
And even though Marvel has taken steps recently to make the Inhumans more prominent with them appearing on S.H.I.E.L.D. and such, they still aren't there yet. So that as a writer, that's got to be a challenge.
It is, but it's also, I mean, I don't take easy books, so I'm not offered easy books, I guess, whatever you want to say, but it's rare that there is not some sort of expectation or challenge along those lines associated with. I mean, Daredevil has the enormous legacy of all the people who've worked on it, and following up Mark Waid, kind of a challenge. Inhuman has all of these other goals to be accomplished with the series beyond just writing a good story. You know, the Star Wars books I'm working on, which I figure we'll talk about in a little while, also have to deliver on certain metrics or however you want to define it,
right,
but also still be very entertaining and very fun and you know, and have to sell at a certain level. So I'm not complaining about it, but it's just interesting that I tend to have books that are you know, there's more to do than just entertain in them.
Right.
But I like it. I'm a multitasker kind of person, and it's always fun to sort of have targets to hit.
Well, I kind of feel like from having talked to you before and reading your books and getting a sense of that, by taking books that have different sort of challenges, it's a way to keep it fresh for you as a writer and show your passion.
Yes. I think that's right. I mean, I don't even really have much more to add. That's a big part of it for me. I think I can get bored easily, and, you know, working on books that have, you know, that are doing something that's easy and succeeding is not, it doesn't necessarily impress even myself, you know, like in the same way that doing something that's hard and succeeding does. And if I want to have a long career in this business, the more times I can do something difficult and do it well, the longer and better it'll be.
Yeah, much more rewarding.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk a little bit about some of the Star Wars books you have going on.
Sure.
Obviously, there's a lot of excitement. I remember you posted on Twitter that your battery had literally died on your cell phone when the Poe Dameron series
got
announced.
That's true. That's what happened. It's everybody likes Star Wars right now. I love Star Wars right now. I really like the new movie a ton. I saw it. I've seen it more than 3.5 times. But Poe Dameron is one of the standouts. So the idea that I get to write a story about this and people are so excited about it is great. It's also, you know, again, a little bit of a challenge because you want to make sure that the experience you're delivering isn't diametrically opposed to what they're expecting. But yet also do something that's true to myself artistically. Fortunately, Phil Noto's drawing it, and he is really, really good at this kind of stuff. So I think I know it's going to look great, which is more than half the battle. It's probably 2/3 of the battle at least. And I'm gonna do my best. I'm working out very hard for, you know, I don't know, it feels like 6 months now, maybe a little longer even.
So you knew before the movie came out.
Yeah. I actually went to Lucasfilm and sort of was given a download on the movie early because I needed to start working. So I knew a lot going into it before I saw it for the first time, which was kind of good and bad. But
kind of got it. So from a writer standpoint, good, but from a fan standpoint.
Yeah, it was a little, I mean, you know, so some of the beats, like I knew, like the reveal of the Millennium Falcon, I knew exactly when that was going to happen and how it was going to be. And so I remember thinking it was very cool when I got it in the download, which was not a moving version of the film. It was like a kind of like a slideshow with a guy narrating it for me, like pretty much all the major beats of the movie. So I knew everything that was going to happen, but so I don't know what it would be like to see it fresh, but I still really enjoyed it. There was still plenty to love. Like, the new characters are just so great. Not just Poe, but Rey and Finn and Kylo Ren. They're all fantastic. BB-8. So it's a fun job.
You mentioned on Friday at your Star Wars panel,
yep,
the setting for this, it's going to take place right before The Force Awakens.
Correct.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
How exactly is the timing of that? You know, I mean, this is an ongoing series, so at some point, if the series takes off and you're writing it for, let's say, 30 issues down the line, like, or are we just going to do the comic thing where we don't say this, it's this specific time? So I'm basically saying you're going to have enough room to tell all the stories before he's got to be where he's at in Force Awakens, right?
It's a great question.
Haven't got there yet.
There's a lot that I can't say.
Okay.
But
fair enough.
Yeah,
fair enough. Okay. The other thing I wanted to ask you about was, much like your Lando, is it going to have a heist feel? Is it that, or is it more action-oriented?
I would say it's closer to Indiana Jones meets Mission Impossible.
Okay.
If that doesn't sound completely bizarre in a Star Wars context.
It sounds really cool, actually.
Yeah, it's closer to that.
So adventure, but yet secret mission kind of thing.
Yeah. Yes.
Sounds really good. And then the last thing I wanted to ask you about as far as Star Wars, this goes along with you not being able to say too much. These are stories in canon.
Yep.
Now, I only know Poe Dameron from whatever I saw in The Force Awakens. Obviously, I wanted more Poe. I wanted more.
Yep, I think we all did. Well, we're going to get it in April, you know.
And so you, as a lifelong Star Wars fan, are getting to create these stories in canon that are going to count, they're going to matter, these Poe stories. That's got to be really, really cool. But at the same time, how much oversight is there? How much interaction is there?
You wanna, there's a thing called the Lucasfilm Story Group, and their job, they're part of Lucasfilm, and it's a group of men and women whose job is to make sure the stories that we're telling, all the stories in the Star Wars universe are, they all work of a piece. So that's video games, comics, movies, TV shows, books, everything. So they want every story to be great, but if a beat that I want to do has already been taken someplace else, then it is what it is. I have to find something else. But as far as kind of stepping on stories and specific kind of like things like that, that's very rare. It's usually like do whatever you want within the you know, as long as what you're doing doesn't contradict or cause a problem with other stories.
Right. So they're not necessarily worried. There's not like kind of the editorial oversight.
Not really.
Like
no.
An extra editor.
No, not really.
So that's easier than I expected.
Yeah, you know, it's always, I mean, there's a lot of expectations riding on any project or anything that's sort of interconnected to a larger universe, because you really do have to, you're playing with a lot of pieces, you don't necessarily see the whole puzzle, because they get to see everything, but I don't necessarily see it all, which
right.
is completely appropriate, and I'm not, you know, it that's good, probably. But, you know, so navigating that can be interesting, because you don't always know everything ahead of time.
But that also assumes a level of trust. They have faith in your abilities as a writer. That has to be...
Yeah, it's pretty nice.
Cool as well. All right, let's talk about Letter 44.
Sure.
My absolute favorite book. It's coming out. Let's give a quick 30-second...
Sure.
For those, so any the, of our listeners
so
who
the,
aren't
the
familiar.
Premise of Letter 44, it's a creator-owned series that I've been doing now for about 3 years. It's about a U.S. president who gets elected, and on his first day finds out that the previous administration, the previous president, you know, they found aliens in the asteroid belt and covered it up. Didn't tell anybody about it. So it's his job now as the new president to decide how he's going to handle this for the planet, for the country, and so on. Like, we know that they're up there. We haven't made contact. We know they're building something, but that's about all we know. So sort of one thread is down on Earth with the president, and the other thread of the story, and they both kind of work in tandem, is that a manned space mission, like a NASA-style space mission, was sent up to see what's there and try and make contact with these people, or whatever they are, these creatures up there. So it reads sort of like House of Cards in space, or West Wing meets Alien, and it's very fun.
Yeah, it's a really incredible book, and it's actually winding down, right? Issue 23 just came out?
Issue 23 just came out, so the collected editions are up to issue 2020, and then the floppies, the single issues that are coming out month by month in stores are up to 23, so the series as a whole will end as planned at issue 35, which has been my planned end point for a long time, and so I've written up through 27, I'm going to write issue 28 shortly, and then, you know, I'll only have, you know, 7 more issues to write, and then it's done, which is very bittersweet for me. I mean, I know what's going to happen, and every one of those issues, I have my Letter 44 notebook at home, has it all outlined, it's all there, so I just have to type it, kind of, which is, it's going to feel very strange. This has been a big part of my life, and has taken me to a lot of amazing places, and enabled me to meet, and hopefully, you know, entertain and influence a lot of people, and so we'll see what happens.
They're sort of heading into uncharted territory, having this first creator-owned project. I mean, was it, when you decided that you wanted to write comics, was this one of the very first ideas that
No, this came to me, I had a few stories before that. My first creator-owned published project was called Strong Man. Then I did a book with Image called 27, a book with Archaea called Strange Attractors, which is pretty fun too, and then Letter 44 began. So this isn't my first creator-owned thing. It's certainly by far the biggest creator-owned thing that I've done, both in its impact and its scope and length. But this year I'm about to jump back in with some new series. I have several things that should be appearing probably within the next 12 months, fingers crossed. And it's nice, but you know, when you have a series that is done as well as Letter 44, there's expectations that come, like my next creator-owned thing has to be pretty cool.
Right.
So, and it is. I'm very excited about it. It's strange and funny, but it's very different. It's not at all like Letter 44. So, you know, but
you're,
I think people like
writer,
my work.
I can't wait to find out what it is. So as Letter 44 is winding down, the story's actually ratcheting it up.
Yes.
The actions, what's going on in the world with the politics, it feels like it's all reaching this climax.
Well, that's what you want, rising action, you know? You want it to, I want to go out with a bang. But I also wanted to have I think that Letter 44 is really a character study between the astronauts and the president, and, you know, it's set against, like, incredible action sequences, and a lot of big stuff happens in it, but you know, it's really about these men and women and intelligences and how they're reacting to the situation and what's going to happen to them. And, you know, I care very deeply about all of them as if they were real people, which is, you know, good and bad considering what's going to happen in the last chunk of story. But, you know, we'll all find out.
It is this fantastical, you know, sci-fi situation. But at the end of the day, the story, I feel, is human drama. It's characterization, it's relationship that makes it compelling.
Yeah.
So you said you knew kind of the overarching story before you even started. Were there any changes along the way? I know as a writer, things organically, anything that surprised you that you...
Yeah, there's always beats that are, you know, things pop up that you didn't necessarily... Like I knew, for example, like I don't want to spoil anything for people who haven't read the series yet, but, you know, there's a beat at the end of the third trade, so at the end of issue 20, where a character that sort of returns, okay? So I knew that was going to happen, but I didn't necessarily know specifically that would be the way that it would happen until...
It was really cool that happened.
Yeah, until, you know, much later. But I knew that I sort of, you know, I put that character away and had that character, and I'm being very vague about it because I don't want to spoil anything, and put that character sort of in my back pocket, knowing that there would be a time when I would figure out, oh, this is the moment. And so when I was working on the arc, the third arc, I write all these sort of an arc at a time, so I'm almost writing a book all at once as opposed to writing it issue by issue, because that way I can figure out surprises like that. Like, oh, this is the time has come to play that card, and then it just, when I figure that out, everything falls into place in this beautiful way, and it's you know, anyway, hopefully it lands.
Oh, it was great. And you mentioned about the politics of the book. I feel like it's very appropriate with what's going on in the politics of the world we're living in today, with this presidential election campaign that I never thought I'd see in my lifetime, with just
crazy.
Like, am I watching politics, or is this a literal circus?
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I hope it settles down. I hope that this is mostly just primary season stuff, because, you know, I think the United States is at a time where it really needs some significant leadership. There's a lot of challenges facing the country as we move into a continually, like, every year we become... You know, the United States' role in global politics has always been extremely significant, but as we move forward now, it just feels like there's this real, extraordinarily connected globalization. Like, climate change is one example, but also, you know, you look at things like the ISIS challenge or you know, migrants moving out of Syria and to sort of spread around the world. The impact of places like India and China industrializing. I could go on. That's an entirely different, very boring conversation for people listening to this, but my point is that I really hope whoever gets that job is up to it, and I feel like the way that the campaign we've seen has been a lot of people who really like the idea of being, you know, like the idea of running for president, and I think when they get in and have to do the job, it's going to be like, oh my God, what did I actually do? So, you know, I just want some competence, and I want some, I don't know, we'll see, man, it's kind of scary.
It is, but if you like politics, you like science fiction, I couldn't possibly recommend Letter 44 higher. It's, like I said, my favorite book. Such a great, great book. Thank you, Charles, for writing it.
Thank you. Thank you for being so effusive in your praise. I love working on it, and I'm so glad that people are finding it and are enjoying it on that kind of level. That's amazing.
Yeah, and thank you so much for your time. It's always great to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks.